Welcome back to Midpoint, friends, on May 20th, 2026. I'm your host, Shelley Reback. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we are bringing you a show on that topic with our friends from the Crisis Center of Tampa Bay. We do have a few Florida and local news nuggets of the week to note before we get there, however. So let me start with what looks like another evil power move by the Republican lawmakers in Tallahassee. You've heard me rail over and over again on this show against the state legislature's propensity to preempt local ordinances. You know, Tallahassee really hates the local laws and regulations that govern the way local communities actually want to live, like protecting their tree canopy, or banning single-use plastics, or banning gas-powered leaf blowers, or even controlling development and urban sprawl. The Republican-controlled legislature doesn't like it when local elected officials try to assert any authority to do what they were elected to do by the communities that elected them. So the Republicans in the legislature preempt those local laws and they take control over the subject, generally to the detriment of the people in the communities that pass those laws. Now we can't protect our trees or ban single-use plastics or regulate gas-powered leaf blowers or protect much of our rural land from developments in our communities because the state's laws have prevented all of that and more. And now the legislature in its special session on the budget has turned their attention to, drumroll, batteries. Yep, it seems they no longer want to allow local governments to require that lithium-ion batteries be recycled rather than thrown in the trash where they are prone to set garbage trucks and landfills on fire. Broward County passed an ordinance that required retailers that sell lots of batteries to let their customers drop off their dead batteries for recycling. The goal was to reduce the number of batteries get thrown in the trash where they can cause fires in garbage trucks and landfills, and they leach heavy metals into the groundwater that we drink. Who could be against this? Your Republican-controlled legislature, that's who. And why? Because Publix and the other big corporations who would be affected by this recycling mandate asked them to. Jason Garcia reports that the state lawmakers in Tallahassee may now step in to kill the recycling program in Broward and throughout the state. Now, you may think this is a small thing, not worthy of all the rage and angst and attention I am giving it. But it is just another example of how the Republicans in the legislature are ending home rule in Florida. And they are concentrating all power in Tallahassee to control the way we live in all of the big and small ways that affect our life in Florida. This is Tallahassee bigfooting over the ability to vote for and to create the kinds of communities that we want in our local jurisdictions. And I, for one, I'm over it. I didn't vote for fires and garbage trucks and heavy metals in my drinking water. How about you? Next, I suppose I have to comment on the raise. There's just no avoiding it. But don't at me. Talk to your local officials about your opinion. This is just my personal opinion, not the opinion of WMNF or its board or my guests. But I have the privilege of sharing my opinion here because I bust my glutes every week to prepare this show and I work for t-shirts. So they give me this platform to talk about things like legislative overreach. I can make no decisions about the Rays Stadium, so talk to the county commission and the city council because they'll decide, which is actually the crux of my opinion. Why should they decide? Why can't we, the voters, decide? The voters of the county previously voted in November of 2024 not to spend community investment tax money, our money, on stadiums. Remember, back in 2024, there was a ballot referendum to extend that CIT tax, and it specified the things that the tax could be used for, like transportation and public works, public safety, public facilities, public utilities, public schools. You get the theme here, public? And guess what? Stadiums were not included. Private sports facilities were not included. So the local officials already know what the voting public's funding priorities are, and yet it seems that they are threatening to ignore them and to spend our money to benefit a private business that is not open to the public, unless you buy a ticket, to create more profit for the team. How is that a public benefit? You know, in the last memorandum of understanding, the Rays are demanding about $976 million in city and county tax dollars, plus $839 million in property tax breaks, and at least $250 million in free land. That's just over $2 billion in subsidies for a stadium that's projected to cost $2.3 billion. $2 billion in subsidies for a stadium that's projected to cost $2.3 billion. How is that a public-private partnership when only the public has to spend and the owners reap all the profits? You know, we're also losing the community college campus, which is a true public benefit because it has to be destroyed in large measure to accommodate the stadium. The Stadium Hawks are counting on the state to fund the college rebuilding, but it now seems that the state legislature wants to wait until the local funding is approved before putting tens of millions of state dollars into the state budget to fund the rebuilding of Hillsborough College. And the stadium will even be exempt from property taxes. So show me the money that comes back to us, the public. Alan Clendenin on Tampa City Council and Ken Hagen on the County Commission, among others, want you to believe that the value to the public is not necessarily in the stadium itself, but it's in the revitalization and development of the area around the proposed stadium in Drew Park. Baseball hawks want to ignore the fact that study after study has shown that that is a pipe dream. Experts and economists have shown that the local community never recoups its investment in sports stadiums from the new development around them. The communities are always saddled with funding the debt. Other public benefits go underfunded, and at least in Tampa's case, where we are a city without a robust public transit infrastructure, and we are taking away transportation funds, well, getting around the area of the stadium will be even more of a nightmare than it already is. So, since I'm not the king of the castle, and since I have no authority over what happens with the stadium, I say put it to a vote of the people. Don't just ignore the funding priorities that the voters have already approved in that ballot measure of 2024. Hold public hearings on the funding and put it on the ballot. If you want it so badly, persuade the people in a public forum. Answer their questions about the plans and see if the voters have changed their collective minds now that there's a chance for baseball in Tampa. If you represent the people, don't ignore them. Oh, all right, let's get to the topic of the day. It is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we are fortunate to have with us our friends from the Crisis Center of Tampa Bay. Ken Gibson is the Senior Director of Marketing and Public Relations at Crisis Center of Tampa Bay. Essentially, he's the communications lead there. He has been with the Crisis Center since May of 2013. And Clara Reynolds, who is a licensed clinical social worker herself, serves as president and CEO of the Crisis Center of Tampa Bay. She leads a staff of over 400 employees who respond to thousands of requests for help every year. All right, let me start with you, Ken. For listeners who may not really be familiar with the Crisis Center, can you please describe what you do and who you serve in the Tampa Bay area?
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and Shelley, just for the chance to talk about mental health and our organization. So we are a local nonprofit organization. We've been in existence for over 50 years, and our mission is to ensure that nobody in our community has to face crisis alone. We really define crisis as a challenge in life that needs a solution. We want to make it as easy as possible for people to connect to different services. And we as an organization do what you might see three or four different organizations do in another county. you know, I'll kind of give you the super quick overview of all the different assortment of services that we do. But we have a telephone contact center where we answer 6 different community lines. Some of them are for the county, some of them are for the state. This includes the 2-in-1 community information line and the 988 suicide and crisis lifeline. We operate one of the community's ambulance services where we do both behavioral health and ambulance transport for Hillsborough County, and actually doing some behavioral health in Pasco County as well. We are the certified rape crisis center in Hillsborough County, where we have 2 locations doing the rape kits. We do trauma counseling in 4 locations in Hillsborough County. And we are have a division called Success for Kids and Families that helps families and kids who are facing various behavioral health challenges through over 10 different programs that they do in the community.
Wow. How has the demand for crisis services changed over the past few years? I mean, you cover the waterfront, really, for various kinds of demands for behavioral health services. But, like, have you seen major changes since, say, COVID in the demand for your services?
We are for a fairly large organization now, we're very good at pivoting to the community's needs. So, the need has changed, and the pandemic was a catalyst for that. We did some specialized things during the pandemic, including vaccines and testing. But we knew fairly early in the during the pandemic that there would be a behavioral health, what we call tsunami. And we've seen that. We are riding that tsunami. We've been doing that for a number of years now. Part of this is we've seen, not just us, but within counseling, there's just increased demand for counseling, which is, it's a good thing. I think it opened people's eyes and made them more open to reaching out. Just the isolation that we all experienced
right.
during the pandemic.
People were so isolated during the pandemic. I mean, some people may not be in crisis per se, but they may need to be able to reach out to someone.
Yeah, it may have been the very first time that they said, okay, something is not quite right, and I need to reach out for help. And that's good. Increased demand. The challenge is being able to meet that demand, but individuals realizing that they need to reach out for help is an important thing.
Let me turn to you, Clara, and ask, like, if more people are reaching out now, who are they, and what are the most common mental health crises that you're seeing right now in this community?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you, Shelley, for having Ken and I on this morning.
Sure.
We really appreciate it. So to answer your question, when we look at communities, I want to say that we have seen an increase across the population, but I'd really like to focus on our youth and young adult population. They are the ones that have embraced behavioral health the most post-pandemic. They are the ones that are now asking for therapeutic support. And as many of these youth are entering the workplace, they're also asking their employers, you need to prioritize my mental health as much as you do my physical health. Mm. And employers are starting to listen. And that trend is obviously, it's much larger in the younger populations, but we are certainly seeing it in the 20, 30, 40. And then it kind of tapers off as we get up into the age ranges. But that's been a really interesting phenomenon
to
see.
I believe that. I believe that there's been a change in attitude toward people seeking out mental health assistance. I mean, when I was coming up, you just didn't do that. I mean, and you certainly didn't want your employer to know that you wanted it or you needed it because it would be detrimental to your job prospects. So that's a totally different attitude that you're seeing now among young people, huh?
And it's so exciting, honestly, from somebody who works in this field, because I believe that this younger workforce is going to be the catalyst to continue this almost renaissance, if you will, in behavioral health and really change the conversation so that it's not, Shelley, as you described, I'm in the same sort of generation, you know, where you were like, suck it up, buttercup. We don't
exactly.
talk about these things.
Mm-hmm.
This is not what we do. It's not real. No, youth, our young adults are recognizing behavioral health is as real and legitimate as physical health.
There's almost this opportunity for reverse mentoring where the older generations, we can learn from the younger generations in terms of how they are normalizing behavioral health and reaching out for help and talking about it and normalizing it. for us to be able to emulate that.
Wow. Well, there are other populations, veterans, unhoused residents. Are they particularly underserved when it comes to mental health care? I mean, we're talking about how the youth are demanding more services, more availability, more space for dealing with mental health issues. But there are these other populations that may not be young who may want mental health care. Do we have that for them?
Absolutely.
For veterans, for unhoused residents, for example?
Absolutely. If we can talk about the veterans first, I mean, certainly, you know, even prior to the pandemic, we all were aware that 23 veterans died by suicide every single day. So the VA made a very big push to open up crisis services to anybody who had served in the military, regardless of whether they were quote unquote eligible for VA benefits. We also saw at the crisis center, particularly starting in 2014, veterans reaching out and asking for help, but then they would ask the second question, what theater did you serve in? What, you know, what was your length of service? And for most of our staff at that time, they would say, you know, I am not a veteran. I did not serve. Thank you for your service. And the veteran would thank us, but they would hang up.
Mm.
We recognized we were missing a population and so created the Florida Veterans Support Line. So that is one of those statewide lines that Ken mentioned that we answer 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, helping veterans and their families get connected to resources outside of the VA or get them connected to resources within the VA, whatever that crisis looks like for them.
And that helpline is staffed by other veterans so that veterans feel like they're talking to people that have a better sense of maybe what their issues are. Right?
Absolutely, because there's nothing like that peer-to-peer connection. Yeah. And the other wonderful thing we've been able to do is expand this. So when a veteran calls, we can de-escalate the situation, we can assess for what's going on, but if they're living in Pensacola or in Miami or in Daytona Beach, we can connect them to somebody, a local veteran, that will help them further, connect them to local resources. One of our veterans said something to me that, and I never served, but said something to me that was really profound. He said, you know, veterans, when they are military members, when they leave the service, they don't leave the service to enter the VA. They leave the service to enter the community. It's the community's responsibility to make sure that services and supports are available for veterans. And that's what I feel like we have really tried to do at the Crisis Center, is to work with our other veteran partners to create a system of care. So no matter what the veteran needs or where they enter, they're getting that help and support in the Bay Area, you know, like they absolutely deserve.
Are there any gaps in the local system that keep you up at night? Are there any, you know, any areas where you feel like, you know, you need more or the community needs more?
I would say for me, and Ken may have a different perspective, the place that we have done a good job, but we're not a great job yet, is in regards to mobile crisis response teams. We have seen that across the country that when an individual is in need of help and support, Shelley, as you and I talked briefly about, calling 911 tends to be what most people do, but that's not the role of law enforcement. Law enforcement aren't trained mental health professionals. They are incredible individuals that are doing the very best with the skill sets that they have. Mobile crisis response, though, is that emergency response that's available. We're so fortunate. We do have that in this community. It is run by Ibis Health, which is literally right down the street from the station. But they will even say the need is not is greater than the availability of services. So if I had my magic wand, right, Shelley, that would be what I would create,
well,
is more
what
access.
Is it exactly? What is a mobile crisis team look like?
It's a licensed clinical professional who is authorized by their license in the state of Florida to not only assess, but to also administer a Baker Act when that is needed. And those are the professionals that should be going out when somebody is in a medical psychiatric emergency, making that determination, versus a law enforcement officer that, you know, has some training, but they are not clinicians. So I would say, if I had that magic wand, Shelley, I would love to see an increase in that service.
So your center does work with local law enforcement agencies, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Describe what that partnership looks like. What kind of training do you provide, if you provide training? And what is the mesh between the Crisis Center of Tampa Bay and law enforcement? Because as you said, most people call 911. They don't know whether a person is experiencing a mental health crisis or there's a major safety risk.
Mm-hmm. Whether medical situation.
Medical,
as well.
Or whether it's abuse, someone is putting themselves in danger or endangering another person. All of those things may be true at once, too, right?
Absolutely.
So what relationship does does the Crisis Center have with local law enforcement?
And I think, Shelley, we've got to define really quickly what local law enforcement is. You know, we are very fortunate in Hillsborough County. We have three municipalities. That's Tampa, Plant City, and Temple Terrace. They all have their own police departments with their own dispatch centers. We have the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office that services unincorporated Hillsborough County, meaning everything outside of those three cities. And they have their own dispatch center. We also know Tampa International Airport has law enforcement. University of South Florida has law enforcement. So as I'm answering this question, I just want to make sure that our listeners know that it is not the same when you call 911. It really depends upon where you're standing at the moment you call 911 of what the response looks like. So for those that are here in the city of Tampa, in the city of Tampa limits, when you call 911, you're going to reach a dispatcher who we have been very fortunate to partner with and provide some enhanced behavioral health training. They're going to do a really quick assessment. And if that individual is struggling in a behavioral health emergency, the Crisis Center has placed within the Tampa Police Department Dispatch Center specialists that will then take those phone calls and do an assessment and spend time to learn and help that individual in crisis. I am thrilled to let you know we've been doing this. July will be 2 years that we have been doing this work, and we have been able to intercept over 50% of those calls. It's almost up to 60% now, Shelley, where somebody calls 911 and law enforcement doesn't even have to respond. We are able to connect them to local resources or a mobile response team, and law enforcement doesn't have to respond. For the other 40%, we're able to de-escalate that individual to where they can communicate to that law enforcement officer when that law enforcement gets on scene what their need is. Because normally that's the place that is the most dangerous.
Right.
When somebody is trying to express what they need, they become heightened, the responder becomes heightened, and that's where the danger level is. So our staff works to de-escalate that person, get them to a place of calm so that when law enforcement shows up, they're able to respond. And we are so proud of that program and pleased with its incredible results. But that's only for City of Tampa. For Hillsborough County, for the other municipalities, their dispatchers are trained to get as much information as possible and dispatch either a law enforcement officer or a law enforcement officer in connection with a behavioral health individual, depending upon the availability.
Yeah, I think the Sheriff's Department does have a behavioral health unit.
Yes, and so does Tampa Police.
And so does Tampa. I noticed that the HCSO has something they call, and I may not be getting this right, but like community assistance people too. I don't know whether those are people who do not have law enforcement credentials or behavioral health credentials. I don't know who they are, but
think of them more as case managers.
Okay.
So you'll have a licensed clinician that rides alongside of a deputy. They go out together. They determine who is going to be the initial responder. But oftentimes, after that initial crisis, somebody may need follow-up support, and that's where those individuals come into play.
Has there been any resistance or challenges in getting law enforcement agencies to embrace this kind of a culture shift, to this idea that people need to be assessed for behavioral health crisis as opposed to immediately jumping to a need for some sort of safety assistance?
It seems like the pendulum is swung very much in that direction with at least local law enforcement in terms of embracing behavioral health and then the need for it and changing the way it gets approached.
Well, since George Floyd, I think, at least in my perception, since the George Floyd incident, it seems like that was when the culture seemed to shift, that people realized that, you know, law enforcement engaging in a way that is perhaps unnecessarily violent, unnecessarily restrictive. You know, maybe that they needed better training or they needed behavioral health assistance in order to determine what kind of response was really needed. At least in my perception, that was when the culture began to change. I don't know whether that's something that you agree with, but
I think it's been kind of it's started slow and it's gained momentum over time. On the communications end of things, you definitely see local law enforcement promoting resources like 211 in the Crisis Center in Tampa Bay when something happens in the community and it somehow ties into behavioral health, letting them know that it's okay to reach out for help. So they are also taking steps to address it, you know, in terms of from an operational standpoint, but then also to do their part to try to normalize it in society in terms of reaching out for help. It's been really great and encouraging to see that part of things.
So you feel that there's more success today with that relationship with law enforcement, and how would you measure that success? You know, how do you measure whether these programs are working? You know, what does your success look like?
60% diversion rate, where it isn't necessary for law enforcement to go out, is one example. So that's there are ways to measure that sort of thing.
Yeah. So what are you saying that what is the 60% diversion?
That was our TPD program where we had our staff in the TPD dispatch center. Mm-hmm. That is an example of one of the areas where we're involved. Unfortunately, Shelley, I don't know what success looks like from TPD's or from the Sheriff's Department's perspective.
Well, what would it take to expand these programs? First of all, so more of Tampa Bay is covered, including the smaller municipalities and the county's more rural areas that you mentioned. What would it take? More money? Is
well,
it always money?
You said a key word with rural. I mean, there is a gap between services that are available, and we're just talking throughout the state in terms of there's more opportunity in behavioral health in general within the metro areas versus the rural areas. And
sure.
That sort of thing has
I mean, you know, medical this, too, medical help too. I mean, let's face it, there's, you know, rural areas have
it's two
less
sides
access.
Of the same coin in terms
right.
of a challenge. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. All right. You're listening to Midpoint on WMNF Tampa, and we are talking about mental health with our friends from the Crisis Center of Tampa Bay. If you've got questions or comments for them, give us a call at 813-239-9663. You can email dj@wmnf.org. You can be anonymous. You can text 813-443-0885. But we are listening, as Fraser used to say, and I'm going to take a call from Steve in Largo, a veteran who's been very patient. Steve, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you, as always, for your great radio station and your show, and your guests as well. It's always fantastic to either train law enforcement or to get somebody else to deal with people who are having a mental health or behavioral health crisis. Law enforcement, they tend, in my experience, to be like alphas. They have to be domineering and power forward in order to do their jobs, protect themselves. They're not the right tool to use. But when I just had tuned in, I heard someone mention Bay Pines. And I can tell you, as a veteran who's been receiving services at Bay Pines for 8 years, it used to be a role model for how all health care should be delivered in the United States. I told Bernie Sanders, stop this Medicare for all and do VA care for all. But since Trump has taken office this time, he has deliberately gutted the VA. This is not a matter of opinion. He did what's called RIFs, reductions in force, and many other policies and actions, including removing hundreds of millions of dollars from research into the PACT Act and veterans' mental health issues. A great article in the great investigative journalism online organization called ProPublica about how veterans are losing their behavioral health and mental health counseling and just walking away from the VA, and many are committing suicide. So the community is responsible for helping the community. But veterans used to be way better helped by the VA. But under the new VA cabinet secretary and under Trump, the VA is being gutted.
I think we get your point, Steve, and I do appreciate it. I think what your point is, pay attention to what our elected leaders are doing and vote accordingly. You know, I'm sorry to hear your reporting on what you believe is happening right now in terms of access to good mental health services at the VA. I don't know whether the crisis center has a relationship with the VA. Maybe you want to say something about that.
Absolutely. And thank you, Steve, and can certainly jump in. Like I said, it is certainly a partnership to serve veterans, and the VA is a very important partner, but it's certainly not the only partner. And again, speaking about Hillsborough County, one of the we have the Florida Veteran Support Line. That number is 844-MY-FL-VET. So if any veteran out there is struggling, maybe struggling to, you've lost your some access, you've lost something.
Regardless of discharge status.
Correct. Yeah. Regardless of discharge status, you can call and we would be honored to see how we can help and support and get you connected to other resources or additional resources or maybe some different VA resources that our incredible veteran staff are aware of. So
they
I appreciate
help,
that call.
They even help individuals navigate the VA in terms of because they have experience in it. They sometimes they know who to call and things like that.
All right, so repeat the phone number.
1-844-MY-FL-VET.
Okay, well, Steve, maybe you want to check that out or refer that number to people that you believe could benefit from it. All right, I want to get into recognizing what is a crisis. You know, we talked about, you know, how people call 911 and they get assessed on the phone. But there are people who are living with people who may be experiencing a mental health crisis. So what are the early warning signs that someone, a friend or a family member, a coworker, might be heading toward a mental health crisis as opposed to just, I don't know, feeling bad or like, you know, aggressive?
Yeah, you start with looking at their behavior. If you know them, how have they been traditionally? And what sort of things are deviating from that behavior? Are they using more, are they taking some more drinks? Are they abusing a different type of substance? Are the sleep patterns getting disrupted? Are they sleeping too much, too little? Are they starting to get isolated? Perhaps they had a robust network of friends and they've been missing from gatherings and things like that. So it's really starting to look at their behavior and really maybe even engaging with them in terms of like, hey, I noticed you haven't been sleeping very well, or you know, you didn't used to drink like this, and asking questions in terms of, you know, what's going on, and be willing to listen to that individual.
So how do you tell whether a mental health crisis is different from someone just having a really hard time? I mean, is there a meaningful distinction, and really, does it matter?
I would vote it doesn't matter whether somebody has been formally diagnosed or they are just really struggling. Both deserve a response. And, you know, to Ken's point, you know, as you're having those conversations, anytime you can use I statements like, I'm worried about you, I'm noticing that these behaviors, you know, you're grabbing that extra drink or, you know, you're sleeping a lot, I'm worried about you. It takes the defensiveness off and it opens the door for conversation. Most of the time, one of the things we hear all the time is that people are throwing out signs and they are waiting for somebody to notice that they're struggling. But so many people are afraid they're going to do the wrong thing. They're afraid that they're either going to push people further into the crisis, or if they intervene, that they're going to get, you know, laughed at or ridiculed for it. We really promote, if you've got that niggle in your belly that something is wrong, listen to it. And it never hurts to reach out and just ask somebody, how are you doing? And when they say, I'm fine, gently pushing back and say, I know what fine looks like for you because I'm close with you. I love you. I respect you. And this isn't fine for you. I really want to help. Talk to me.
So if someone's worried about a person who keeps pushing help away, though, how do you stay connected without pushing them further? You know, I mean, some people don't react well to that kind of push.
Absolutely. Know? It's a lot of I statements. It's not you that there's something wrong with you. It's I'm noticing that you're struggling. I really want to be helpful for you. And when you're ready, I'm here. Again, you may just be cracking that door open, but if you continue to make those cracks, you're showing that person who may have had that door slammed in their face so often that they were afraid to walk through it. If you continue to open that door, eventually they're going to talk.
It may take some persistence.
Yeah.
More,
it does.
More than one, it takes more than, especially if you're talking with a teen, because it takes a lot to pry that information out from them. And some of this as well, we've talked about working with teens and youth.
I have an email here from someone who wants to talk about teens and youth. This is from Nat, who says, I want to bring attention to the lack of providers for youth, in particular tweens and teens. My son is 15. I've waited several years for him to be old enough to see a provider or for a provider to work with him. I don't know what can be done to attract more providers to this area or to encourage them to work with youth at younger ages, but something needs to be done. This is a person who's obviously having trouble finding the right provider to work with their tween or teen. What can we do about that?
It's an example of each person's circumstance and situation is unique. So I would suggest that the individual reach out and call 211 and explain the situation and really be transparent in terms of what's going on and even some of the barriers that they've experienced. Who have they reached out to already? Why are they running into struggles in getting help? There's no be-all, end-all solution, but sometimes by having a conversation, you can kind of tap into, okay, what's the root of the situation? And what sort of resources are available?
Calling 211 may be one way to get more help
about community resources.
Or appropriate referrals to community resources. I have another email here from the anonymous family who says, who might one reach out to in the county when concerned about medical negligence? In other words, there are people who may be exhibiting signs of a mental health crisis who are really having a medical problem and don't have the resources to get to a doctor or what have you. What should that person do?
Well, if they're concerned about a vulnerable adult, a vulnerable child, I would really encourage them to call the Florida's abuse hotline, 1-800- No. Oh, boy. I'm looking at Ken. I'm drawing a blank on the number. I'm so sorry. I've got so many numbers in my head.
Yeah, sorry,
but
I don't have that one.
But that really is that gateway to let the state know so that somebody can come out and investigate. If you don't feel comfortable doing that, again, I would recommend calling 211. Let us help guide you in what's the best scenario, what's the best thing to do.
So 211 is like a kind of a catch-all
clearinghouse,
clearinghouse for community resources.
Correct.
Right? So whether it's you're unhoused, you're having a medical problem, you're having a mental health problem, these are all things that 211 can help direct you toward resources that are available.
We have over 3,000 different resources in our database, and you may say, "Well, I can do a Google search for that, or I can use AI." Sometimes people are dealing with a symptom, but there are underlying problems. So part of what the people that answer just at the crisis center, the individuals who answer the calls, they receive extensive training, both in terms of resource navigation and also in providing emotional support.
So is 211 the crisis center number to call? Like whether it's someone, a suicide call or I need, mobile mental health assistance or I need to be referred to somewhere to live tonight. I'm with my children. I just lost my housing. I'm in my car. Is it all those things? And is it the crisis center that staffs it?
Crisis center staffs two lines, 211. Think about somebody who has a need, but it's not urgent or acute. 988 is this crisis and suicide hotline. So in those examples, Shelley, I would recommend those individuals calling 988, You're going to get connected to resources. We're going to be able to do that assessment and get you the connected to that help and support that you need. 211's really designed to be, I've got some concerns. I need help finding a resource. And I hope that helps to clarify. But you can call either one of those numbers. Both get answered at the Crisis Center of Tampa Bay.
Okay. So if someone suspects that a loved one is in crisis, is that the single most important thing that they should do first, is to make that call? Or what should they do first?
It's really, if you think they're in immediate danger, that's going to be a 911 call.
911.
You're going to want to, if you think there is like that day, there's
they're
like
a danger to themselves or others.
Yeah, that's what we encourage. And then, but aside of those situations, calling 988 is a solution to for both if the individual themselves are struggling or if you have a concern for a family member or friend.
Absolutely. And the only thing I would add, Shelley, to kind of help those that may be a little confused, it's the access to some sort of lethal mean. Yeah. If you know your family member, your friend has access to a gun, has access to hurt themselves, and it's easy access, you definitely want to call 911. If you feel like somebody has talked to you about suicide, but they don't have a plan, they don't have access easily to lethal means, absolutely call 988.
Okay, that is really good advice, I think. I hope our listeners take that and take it to heart, sure, because I think that's really good advice. I know that there is probably a hesitancy among some people for calling 911, especially in certain communities, in the Black community, for example. You know, there may be a I need to think twice before I call 911. So that I think that that's really helpful advice in terms of framing the difference between calling and potentially putting someone in danger from law enforcement, besides being in danger to themselves or others. So I appreciate that advice. All right. What are some things that like well-meaning people sometimes say or do that actually might make the situation worse?
You'll be fine. Don't worry about it. You know,
buck up,
buttercup.
Yeah. You think you have it bad? Let me tell you about how bad I have it.
Yeah, that's probably a big
We hear that a lot. You know, a person's really, they're ready to talk about what's going on with them, and they just get completely interrupted. Or, you know,
let
to Ken's point.
Let me make it about me.
All about me.
You think your divorce was bad? Guess what happened to me?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, we're laughing about that, but oftentimes that's what happens. You know, people get either, they've got needs themselves, or they get uncomfortable. And so they go back to what they know. The most important thing, Shelley, that anybody can do is when you ask that question, how somebody is doing, is close your mouth and let people talk. You don't have to say a word. It's almost simple. Validate how they're feeling. Oh my gosh, Shelley, it sounds like you are really struggling. Tell me more. Keep opening that door. It is the act of actually talking about it that starts that path to healing. But we always tell people, and Ken knows this, always make sure you've got your cell phone ready. Because if somebody says something to you or you're feeling overwhelmed, that's when you can call us. You can call 988 together to help get your family member, your friend, to the help and resources that they need.
That happens. It can be a lot, even if somebody wants to get help, just the act of calling can be overwhelming for somebody. So kind of giving them the assist in that and saying, okay, let's call together. And that way it's just, they're getting some help in that sort of thing. It's okay to do that sort of thing.
And you're modeling for the next time. So that if they're, you know, if they're struggling at 3 a.m. or at 2 p.m. and you're not available, you've now modeled how somebody can get help immediately.
So what happens when they call 988 and they say, and the assessment person comes to the conclusion that they need help? What happens? Literally, do they send someone out? Do they give them, like, is there a walk-in center where a person can go to immediately to speak to a counselor or, you know, a different kind of hotline? I mean, what actually happens when they call
988? I think the way to approach it is the more typical situation. Most, like, the vast majority of our calls it's a phone call. So because somebody is having thoughts of suicide or they have concern about somebody, the in terms of like a rescue type of situation, that's not the typical situation. Very much so.
Mm-hmm.
It's having a conversation with somebody. We're gonna the specialist is trained to ask questions, determine the potential.
So can they stay on the line for like a long time?
Yes.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, to Ken's point, if you look at the national statistics of 988, it's well over 97% of calls to 988 are managed or resolved by the end of the phone call. It is less than 3% of the time where what is called active rescue has to actually be implemented. Mm. And in active rescue in our community is usually getting law enforcement out. So we will stay on the phone with the individual and we'll work in conjunction with one of our other team members who will call law enforcement, and together we will make sure that person gets to safety.
And that's where they're indicating they have intent and the means is right there,
it's
a dangerous situation.
Okay. Yeah. So how should someone take care of their own mental health when they're supporting someone else who's in crisis?
It does start with yourself in terms of, we always promote self-care in terms of eating right, exercise, getting enough sleep. I've noticed that as I'm getting older, the importance of sleep. But it's also reaching out for help. So if just like you, if you had a heart condition or you had a disease or something along those lines, we want to be able to normalize these conversations.
All right. I'm going to take a quick call from Bob here about the hotline. Bob in St. Pete, you're on the air. Please make it quick.
Okay, I'll make it quick. Yeah, I called one of those numbers because my grandson was having an emotional crisis. And they came out and they aggravated him to the point where they had to Baker Act him. He ended up in PEMS because I called that number. He was short on medication and he needed more medication. And apparently he had to have a meeting with a psychologist or psychiatrist before the medication. And they aggravated him to the point where the police came and took my grandson away. You got to be careful when you call that number.
Well, let me let our guests respond to you, Bob, about
okay.
that. Thank
sure.
you.
Sure.
Very quickly, do you have a response for Bob?
First of all, Bob, I'm so sorry that happened. And it is different in different communities. So what it looks like when you call 988 in Pinellas is different than Hillsborough. So again, I am so sorry that happened. And if there's any way that we can be of assistance, please reach out via our website.
You're not in Pinellas, right?
We are not in Pinellas, correct.
Okay.
We're only in Hillsborough County.
Okay.
But if you would like more information, Bob, please go to our website, crisiscenter.com. Give us your information and we can help navigate some services in Pinellas, because at some point your grandson is going to come back in the community and we want to make sure you've got the resources you need.
All right. So for any listener who themselves is struggling right now, what do you want them to hear today?
I'm going to start, but then I'll pass it over to Ken. First of all, it's okay to not be okay. But please take steps to get help. That's the most important thing. We're all struggling right now. There's a lot happening in the world, a lot happening locally that may be impacting us. And that's absolutely okay. And every one of your feelings is okay and important and yours. And we want to support you, though, to get you to a place of better. So reach out and ask for help.
Yeah. I think there's increased isolation in the world we live in, kind of going back to, the pandemic contributed to that, and there's just a ripple effect of it. So fight against that. Connect. Find people that you trust. That can be a friend. It can be a coworker. It can be a minister. It can be a professional. And we're always there at 211-988 to be able to talk if you need to.
So if you both could change one thing about how Tampa Bay or Florida approaches mental health policy to make it easier for people who are struggling, what would that change be? As I said, I talk about, policy, public policy in the legislature and local government on every show. So what do you think you would like to see in terms of changes in policy?
Money doesn't solve everything, but funding for programs, just continuing the growth that's happened in the state to be able to fund behavioral health programs.
Well, is there some program that you'd like to see put, you know, funded that you haven't been able to put out there because you lack the funding? Is there something that, or is there personnel that you'd like to bring on board that you haven't been able to do?
Selfishly, I would love to be able to staff every dispatch center across the state of Florida with trained behavioral health intervention individuals like we have with Tampa Police Department.
So that doesn't exist now?
No.
Oh.
Tampa is the only place right now where that exists.
Oh,
the
wow.
City of Tampa. I will tell you, if you can reduce the number of individuals that are coming into the system via 911, we can make a huge difference in the ultimate outcome. So if I had my magic wand, again, mm-hmm. Shelley, I've been talking a lot about this magic wand today, that would be where it is, because we know our local police chiefs would love to be able to do what we're doing. Budgets just haven't allowed it so far. So that would be great.
Hmm. And I wonder where that funding would come from, like out of the police budget or direct funding from, say, the legislature to programs like yours.
Absolutely. Or direct funding from like the Attorney General's office to our local law enforcement partners so that they could either develop it internally or allow us the opportunity to come in and help. And I know our partners, we have 13 different centers across the state of Florida that look similar to us in the 211 and 988 work that they do. I know they would love to be more involved.
And it's an investment.
It is, absolutely.
Our community, our businesses, when we are doing just like medical care, if we're providing good behavioral health care, then we as a community benefit and the community prospers because of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any relationship with sort of inpatient centers for mental health?
Yes.
Okay. So do you work with them?
Oh, absolutely, because we provide that transport. So again, usually in most communities, either law enforcement or a licensed clinician, medical professional, will determine if somebody meets the legal requirement for a Baker Act, meaning that the person is a danger to themselves or others. When that happens in Hillsborough or in Pasco County, we provide that transport to that receiving facility. So it is usually an inpatient. It is a 72-hour mandated hold, or up to 72 hours, better said. And we are very fortunate in Hillsborough, Pasco, Pinellas to have a very robust network of those beds available for children and adults.
Okay. Well, last question. What gives you hope about the direction things are heading?
For me, it's youth.
Yeah.
The fact that youth have really embraced behavioral health as real is huge for me. Ken?
I thought the exact same thing. Once again, it goes back to we can learn. I am Gen X, and I think that we can learn from Gen Z and Gen Alpha in terms of their transparency and their willingness to seek help. And I think if all generations did that, we'd be a better society.
Hmm. Okay, last note, where can people go? Give the numbers again, the website, all of that information.
ChristCenter.com to learn more. And the two main numbers are 211 for community resource information and 988 for crisis and immediate emotional support.
24 hours a day,
yes.
365.
Holidays, weekends, 3 in the
right.
morning.
Okay.
Hurricanes. We're always there.
Yep.
All right, that's all we have time for today, my friends. Talking Animals with Duncan Strauss is up next after the NPR News. I see Duncan in the next studio, followed by Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter with The Conversation at noon. Before we roll into music, here on WMNF Tampa.
Time is truly wasted.